Hello again from Holden Village, way up here in the Cascade Mountains. Today is July 3rd, 1997, and there's a teaching session going on now by Ingrid Christiansen, and it's entitled Writing the Stories We Know, and subtitled Illness and Death, Visiting the Stranger. So let's join Ingrid on this session.
I'm Ingrid Christiansen, and this is a session called Illness and Death, Visiting a Stranger. It's part of a writing workshop that I sometimes do. I will invite you to take part in a little writing exercise during this for 12 minutes at some point. If you don't want to write, you certainly don't have to. And then after the 12-minute exercise, anybody who wants to share what they've written can. But again, there's no pressure on you to do that. That will come later, however. First, we'll talk about some other things. So, well, this session on illness and death, I wanted to begin by reading a passage out of Revelations. Last week in Bible study, we were looking at Revelations, and it is so... It's such a wonderful book, and full of such odd stories.
Right.
I always sort of worry about them.
Yeah.
Yes. That some things that I just cherish in the Bible are encapsulated in this mishmash of such odd stories. But Barb Rossing last week in Bible study really helped us to see that they weren't so odd, and so I felt sort of affirmed by that. But let me read you what it says here. These are words that almost always make me cry, so I'll try not to cry this time as I read them. But they're so lovely. It's in chapter 21. I always think it's important that it's right at the end of the Bible. One more page you turn and the Bible's next.
That's it.
So this is a nice promise. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. I asked Barbara about that, and she said the first heaven and the first earth would be probably now, where we are now. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. I like it that this has, as an image of heaven, it has a city, because I teach urban studies in Chicago, and I love cities. And that heaven comes to earth rather than us going somewhere, I think is sort of a nice image of promise. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "See, the home of God is among mortals. God will dwell with them as their God, and they will be God's peoples, and God himself will be with them. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more, for the first things have passed away." So it's really a promise that I just wanted us to keep in the back of our minds during this, because sometimes talking about illness and death is very difficult and sad. And we have this wonderful promise from God that death will be no more. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more. So I think that's just kind of a background piece. I wanted to talk about death in a writing workshop and illness because I feel as though it's a subject that's sort of taboo in our culture. And we all have wisdom. We all have experiences. We've all known things about this. We all know stories of people who have gone on a path toward death and died. And we need to share those stories with each other. It's natural to share them at funerals, but then we kind of expect everyone to get over it. And we quit talking, and we don't talk enough about it. And, you know, a friend of mine who's a sociologist says that for years, women's gossip, coffee clutches, getting together to talk, or, you know, overtending of children and preparing of meals, talking was a way of doing sociology, a way of teaching each other life skills and survival skills. But now we're more isolated from one another and we don't do that so much. So in a place like Holden where we really can do it, I think we should. I'm of course not an expert on this subject. I mean, I'm just the opposite. I'm a seeker. I'm listening. I want to learn from a community of Christians what we know about death and dying, too. We need to share our stories. Stories are one of the oldest ways of communicating. Myths, stories. I mean, Dan was talking about it in Bible study this morning, how important stories are. And Dan has told a Bible study story both yesterday and today about death, both of which brought tears to my eyes. Yesterday, the story was, he was talking about people who, every day in their family practice of life, put the sign of the cross on one another's foreheads and say, remember that you are a beloved child of God. And he told a story about leaving a child for college and the child asking to be marked sign one more time. And then this story of a man who was dying, and his wife was at his bedside, and he said, sign me one more time. And that was the last thing he said to her, which of course she did. And today, the story, right at the end of Bible study, I was going to remember it.
Yeah, the little mother of two children.
Oh, yes, the forgiveness story.
Yes, right. Yeah, very impressive.
The surprise forgiveness. He said the surprise thing seemed to be take them off guard. The lower guard.
Right, and to be willing to look in the eye of the officer who accidentally killed your four-year-old child and say, I forgive you. And how, what a moment of grace that was in everyone's life. And imagine all the good it did. I mean, that officer then would be inclined to not have been hardened by the experience of accidentally in a chase situation, driving his car to death, having killed this child, but would be softened by it, would be less hostile and violent person in his life as an officer of the law. So,
what is so neat is that then he took that story and put it into your life, and he said, do that. It's very powerful. And how powerful it is to forgive and do it quickly.
Yeah, she just
with
got
a real feeling, you know. What a power thing it is. And I think it's so great to tell a story and then really drive it home.
Yeah, it certainly is. So, because we're not alone, and because we can do that, telling stories, I thought that it would be nice to gather a group today to do some storytelling about this. I wanted to remind us all that research shows, you know, the famous research, that people who are diagnosed with life-threatening illnesses do much better if they do the path of their illness in community. Statistically, I mean, your chance of survival, your longevity, your amount of pain you experience in your illness, all of those things are diminished if, first of all, specifically if you are in a parish where people pray for you or where you can share this information with others and they will be a support group for you. And if you're in a community of people who you can share this with. Last week there was a member of the board here at Holden, Bob Quello, who's a pastor and who is much beloved by this community, but who has very serious cancers. And he came, he normally has just the hair like yours, just a full head of white hair, really beautiful. And he's bald as a cue ball now from all of his treatments. But what a dear man. And he said he just decided, he had just moved to a new parish when this diagnosis came, been there 9 months. And he decided to share the story of his illness with his parish as it unfolded as a model. And he said to them in sermons, this is a challenge to you. I am modeling the behavior I want to see from you in this parish. And he's doing very well. I mean, he's really, he gets a lot of strength from people and people's love. So there are reasons to do this. People's experience of death is very different than children's experience of death. And often if there's a death in the family, the children are neglected and not honored as having their own experience of this, which is very important. And so to illustrate that, I'm going to tell you the story of a death. Our friend Jim Mayer, who is the head of missions for the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church, was diagnosed with, he came back to the States and waited way too long to seek treatment and assumed he had some dread bug from some country he'd visited. He was lived in India a lot, and he had cancer. He was diagnosed with a very serious cancer and of the bowel, and he called us to tell us this. My husband, he lives in St. Louis. My husband and I and our children live in Chicago. We're good friends. We're different generations, but we're very good friends. And so my husband, who is very bad at things like this, he's not good at emotion, he's not good at personal unhappiness, was spectacular. And over the telephone immediately, he said to Jim, "We always work together. We do work, we go to meetings, we go to conferences, we organize things. Now that you have this diagnosis, let's play together. Let's you and Sammy's Jim's wife, and Ingrid and I go to Wisconsin and have fun." So we set up a weekend and went, a long weekend, to go to Wisconsin. We went to Spring Green, we went to American Players Theater, we stayed in a Frank Lloyd Wright hotel, we did, you know, ate good food, and talked and had fun and laughed. But in the midst of this weekend, my husband, who, as I said, is not good at these things, not good at emotion, not good at facing, sort of, he wishes the illness would just go away, said, "Jim, use the fact that you're dying to do some good. Figure out how you're going to use this. Figure out what you want to do with your last year or two or whatever it is." And he got Jim's attention. And Jim thought about what he really wanted to see happen, what his gift to the church, his last gift to the church could be. And he decided that, we all decided, of course, now here we were on this vacation playing, and we ended up working, planning something, forming an organization. We formed an organization called Justice Network in the Lutheran Church. At first it was called New Wine Exchange, and then gradually it grew into something called Justice Network in the Lutheran Church. Jim decided that he wanted to use his authority and clout and power and sort of psychological strength that a lot of people loved him and respected him. He was a pastor that was a model pastor in lots of ways. He decided he wanted to use this as a call to all kinds of people all over Lutherandom to say all people who are involved in justice work around this church should come together into a central organization and do some good together, help each other, stand in solidarity with each other. So this was his mission and his dream. We did work on it, we talked about it. Jim started coming every other weekend from St. Louis to our house where we would sit and plan and work and get organized on this thing. When Jim died, he had eight children. He and Sammy had eight children that they'd had during their time in the mission fields in India. And all eight children came to St. Louis to be with them in Jim's last days. They had a big king-size bed, and on the night that he died, there were people in and out of that bed all night long. Jim, Sammy, the children, I mean, all the children were adults by then. During the evening, Jim said, "I would like us to have Holy Communion." And so they got it organized, and he served Holy Communion to he and his wife and his eight children. And the family always jokes about the fact that during the middle of this, he had to race to the bathroom, and then came back and just finished the service of Eucharist. And of course there were many tears, but it was clear that he was near the end. He was very weak. He was 6'4" or something and sort of tall, bent by that man. And then he came and went from his typewriter. So the king-size bed, the typewriter, and Holy Communion were the three things going on that night, and his children. And at the typewriter, he was writing the letter of call to call all these organizations to come to the first conference of this organization, the New Justice Network in the Lutheran Church. Finally, he would sleep, he would go to the bathroom, he would go to the typewriter, he would sleep. Finally, sometime toward morning, he finished the letter. It was still in the typewriter. In those days, we didn't have computers so much, but it was in the typewriter. And then he went back into the bed, and everyone was around, and within an hour or two, he was dead. So, of course, we sent the letter out after he died. But it was a very satisfying death, and it was a death that was full of lessons for all of us. Then, the next day, now is a different story. I think when we think about point of view in writing and telling stories, we need to think about this. The next day, my four-year-old, Marcus, who is a maverick at Holden Village now, 18, heard that his friend Jim had died. Every time Jim had come to our house over all these years, he and Marcus had been chums. Jim was a carpenter, Marcus was a carpenter. Marcus had a little wooden workbench out on the porch that had a steel vise on it, and it had hammers and nails and things in it. And he and Jim would go out on his workbench and work every time Jim came. You know, this dear man who was quite ill in his middle 60s, and my four-year-old bonded somehow. And so Marcus would toddle around following Jim here and there. And Jim was, as I said, 6'4 or something, and Marcus was about this high. So they were very dear friends. But this was sort of a sub-theme to all of our grown-up ideas. You know, we were all excited about this new organization, and we were grieving ourselves the loss of this dear friend. And so when I told Marcus the next morning that Jim had died, we had been preparing Marcus. Jim was going to die, Jim was going to die, Jim was going to die. But Jim would come back every 2 weeks and stay at our house. And so it was clear evidence that Jim wasn't going to die from his point of view. But when I went to school, I made it to Marcus's school, his kindergarten, at noon, junior kindergarten. And when I walked in the door of the junior kindergarten to tell Mrs. Hayes, his teacher, Marcus is going to be going through some things in the next week or two. You know, his parents are going to have to go to a funeral lots away, and we'll have a babysitter, and he's... Mrs. Hayes walked up to me, and she had tears in her eyes. And she said, "I don't know who Jim is." She said, "I don't know if Jim is a child or an adult. I don't know anything about Jim except what Marcus told us this morning." She said, "I started show and tell, and Marcus said, I have to talk." And he walked to the front of the class, and he told the class about his friend Jim. And he told the class that Jim had died. And she said, all the four-year-olds were rapt. They listened. And since then, they surrounded Marcus with love. And she said, she said, "I don't know who Jim is, but I understand that Marcus is very sad." And it really taught me a lesson. You know, here we were, being grown-ups, doing our thing, busy here, here, here. And here this little boy had this simple understanding of the significance of this loss for him and of the importance of his community. He went to his friends,
his group.
Yeah. And so,
smart little boy.
Yeah. You could do a few model happy figures for him too.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Sure.
Because how many four-year-olds would?
Yeah. Great.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, he's come to Holden Village every summer of his life. So, when you're telling a story of a death, you can pick a thread. You can decide, I want to tell a story around this theme or that theme. So I just quickly, before we start to write ourselves, I want to say a few things about writing stories. Stories have beginnings, middles, and ends. You need to think about them a little bit. I'm going to give you a suggested beginning for your story, a first line. So if you start to write, you might use that line. You can, of course, not use it. The middle of a story, I think the best advice you can have for writing a story is think of as many details of your senses as you can. What did it look like? What did it sound like? What did it smell like? What did it feel like? About Marcus's little story, you could describe the workbench, you know, the details of that. You could describe show and tell. You could see, it's important to know, you could even describe the disparity in height between Jim and Marcus. It's some concrete details help the reader. I think it's important in the middle of a story to tell the story of one event. Don't generalize about deaths, but tell one thing that happened, one death, one place, one afternoon, one time, rather than generalizations. The story grips people more. It makes them understand. I mean, Dan's stories in Bible study are better because they're about specific precise.
Yeah.
And then I want to say just a word or two about point of view. The story in the Bible about a death that I wanted to use today is the story of the pillar of salt. And the actual death that's reported in the Pillar of Salt story is one line. Does anyone remember it? Here it is.
Where she turned to salt?
Yep. Mm-hmm. That's it. But Lot's wife behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt.
What gripped me was looked back.
Yeah.
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 Looked back.
And so then I think, I mean, this whole chapter 19 in Genesis is, first of all, Lot is a dreadful man, in my view. He takes in these two angels who come to the town, and that's very generous. You know, two men come to the town and who are actually angels. He says, come stay at my house. They say, okay. And then there's this violent scene of this crowd outside demanding that he give these two men, the angels, out to the crowd to be raped. He says, oh, no, no, it's my word of honor that I took these two men in. I'll give you my two daughters instead. Nice guy. My two?
I forgot.
Right. He says, I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Look, I have two daughters who have not known a man. Let me bring them up to you to do to them as you please. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof. And then so first of all, this guy's, so here's Lot. Then Lot's wife gets killed. The angel says, don't look back. She looks back. She's killed. And then he goes on in the last part of chapter 19 is, oh, it's just ridiculous. Lot and his two daughters go and stay in a cave, and in the cave they get a drug, and one has sex with him one night, and one has sex with him the next night while their father is drunk, and they both get pregnant by their father. Now, so it's a very problematic chapter, but I just started thinking about Lot's wife. And I'm like, why did she look back? So if we were to write this chapter from her point of view, first of all, she's just been through this thing. Her husband has offered to give her two daughters up for probable death and certain gang rape. Then they're fleeing. These two angels come. They say, flee the city. Lot says, oh, no, I don't want to flee the city. Then the angels say, really? You have to flee the city. And Lot says, no, I don't want to flee the city. And then the angels say, take him by the hand and force him to flee the city. And then he says, well, don't make me go to the country. At least let me go to a small town. So the angels say, oh, all right, you can go to a small town. So they put him, literally, that's what it says here. And they put him in a small town. But she then is giving up her home, and she wants to look back and see what happens to the town of Sodom. Now, she could do that because she's disobedient, and you could say, well, she got what she deserved, because the angel said, don't look back, and she looked back. So she couldn't follow instructions. She could say she was dumb. No, she couldn't get it that the angel said don't vex, so she couldn't follow instructions. You could say she did it because she. You could write the story as though she's curious. She needed to know. She wanted to be able to tell the story of what happened to her hometown. So she wanted to know for history's sake. She wanted to know because she was opposed to secrets. She didn't want to have a secret kept. But she needed to know. You could say she's the perfect example of the nameless woman. We don't even know her name. Lot's wife, Lot's wife.
It's true.
So you could write a story about namelessness and how important it is to name things. You could say this woman is becoming an immigrant. She's having to move. People didn't move in those days. She's having to leave her home, everything behind her. Of course she looks back because she wants to know what she's come from to bring herself into the future. She's the image of silence. This story is told about her. She doesn't get to tell it. So if we wanted to write a story about the image of silence and the reasons for silence, is she silent because of fear, because of humility? Does she not have language? Is she ashamed of something? She must have been an abused wife. I mean, I think anyone would do that.
To let her husband know what?
Yeah.
I can't imagine such
a thing. Maybe she was trying to commit suicide.
Maybe she wanted to die.
It could be a story of suicide.
Sure.
She wanted to die. So you see, you could write the story of her death, any number of ways. The book, the 19th chapter of Genesis, could be a novel. I mean, it's got incest, it's got tragic death, it's got, you know, this whole business with the mob scene. And so there are so many points of view that you could use to write this story. So, and my point to this is this little exercise of realizing the points of view about one line, really, in the Bible, is that we can shape and name our own stories, and we should. It's important to say, what is my story? What is my spin on this? What is my interpretation? The experience of Jim Mayer's death was very different for Marcus than it was for me. But he needed to be able to say his story, just as we need to be able to say ours. And of course, you can change it. You can change the main character, you can change the time. If a story is very painful to write, sometimes it's helpful to write it in the 18th century or in the 23rd century. And then you can give yourself some distance just by changing the place or the time. But it's important to name the stories and to write them. So I think that's what we should do now, is do some storytelling, writing. Maybe I'll read you a couple of opening lines of stories and just comment on the way other people have done them. Well, obviously the classic opening line is once upon a time. Another one is in the beginning. Another one is and it came to pass in those days. This one, it was a bright day, a hot day, the day old Mr. Prescott died. Here's for Sissy Miller, Gilbert Clandon, taking up the pearl brooch that lay among a litter of rings and brooches on a little table in his wife's drawing room, read the inscription, "For Sissy Miller, with my love." So, a kind of concrete, specific, little tiny act that makes you wonder, who is Sissy Miller? Why is this brooch? Why is this man going through her brooches? What's the story here? So it's a platform to kind of move us into the story. Here's a much more generalized beginning. It was so dark in the ravine, it's like it was a dark and stormy night. There's another. It was so dark in the ravine that at first she could not see the horses. Then her eyes grew accustomed to the gloom. So there are any number of ways, and you can use different persons. You can be first person or third or whatever you'd like. We don't have time to talk about all that now. So I would like us to just write, and then if anyone would like to, you can read what you've written. And the sentence that I would suggest, here are pens if you don't have them, here's backsides of paper, that's a folder we'll use for writing paper, the concrete details. So just tell the story. You could start this, she was, they were, I was, you were, you could go into any of those tenses. But she was the last to leave the room, or they were the last to leave the room, is my for an opening line. But if you don't want to use that opening line, use another opening line. Or they were the last people to leave the room. And of course, that could be the last story, the end of the tour. You could come around back to that place that they're leaving the room. So my suggestion is that you hardly take your pen off the paper. Just write. Let it come. Whatever comes, comes. Don't cross out. Just keep going. 12 minutes.
Remember three sentences?
Right.
Couldn't think of a thing to say.
That looked great, didn't it? She just, yeah. Oh, that was great.
Now, did you write part of one sentence or did you write a whole page?
Me? I just, the last time I saw the beginning line, that was all. She mentioned my dog and then it was over and I couldn't.
Couldn't do it.
No.
But she didn't realize that raining.
Yeah.
It's great, you know.
I'd be crying.
That's okay. I cried when my
It's important to try. I went to a concert and so one of my singer she cries at least once a day because it makes her voice better.
Right, yeah.
Have a great day, girl.
Yeah.
I'm a singer. She cries at least once a day, makes her voice better. Just stick around here some stories.
There are probably several people that would want to share these stories now, and you certainly shouldn't if you don't want to, but we would like to hear whatever stories people want to share. The rule of in a workshop like this, the thing would be that we would not critique stories, but we would give thanks for what we appreciated them, and tell the person what we liked about what they were. So that's the way I'd like us to proceed.
I'll read if you want me to.
Okay.
But I also want to make add one more thing.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Just to have people feel more comfortable with what they're reading. That, you know, sometimes, especially things like this, you're talking about some things that are a little bit sensitive to you, and that you need to respect those things in the village, you know? Like, oh, that woman wrote.
Right.
Use your judgment about what you want to share and not share.
I'm not trying to say, don't feel bad if we cry. Feel bad if we
have a hard time getting through it.
Just not to.
And that's true, too.
Not to.
Yeah, that's certainly true. Yeah. But I think we welcome tears. And I often bring them tissue, these things. Let's But we may not. I mean, it's also possible to write funny stories about that.
Sure.
So, why don't you begin?
Okay. I know that death is very near. My dear 90-year-old friend will soon leave me. She's taught me so many good things about life. But the most important great thing I was taught was patience. For many years, I took her for lunch, which she claimed was her fun time. However, she was very, very deaf and had little vision. So communication was kind of sparse. I would order food and then with her loose false teeth, she would take each bite and chew it several times before she'd swallow. Lunch lasted an hour and 45 minutes to 2 hours. One day I asked if she had finished. And she said to me, "I just hate being rushed when I eat." So many lunches later, I learned patience from a 90-year-old beautiful lady.
I gave my gift of patience back as I sat and gave comfort at her death. You're just nodding your head.
Well, it's not so savory.
Oh.
Yeah, right. Because what you've done there is not tell us the story of her death, but you've told us the story of her life and what you cherished about her.
Yeah.
And given us a very good, clear picture of what those lunches were like. And so with those details about the lunches and her loose, false teeth. And the point for me, the point of it that you made so beautifully was this, what the gifts you gave each other, the kind of reciprocal gifts. Who else would like to comment on that?
It's a hard name to follow.
Look at this.
No, it's lovely. Did you get the sense of fear or panic or that this stuff was frightening or
some of these tributes?
So it's very different from lots of other deaths. You know, what made this death feel peaceful to you, do you think?
Friendship.
Yeah.
Yes. She wasn't alone.
She wasn't alone.
In the sense that woman is living on because of your memories of her.
That's right.
And that she had done for her friend.
Yeah.
I think it's easier for us to let people go when we feel we've done for
them. Right.
Peacefulness that comes from knowing that you've really come through for this person somehow. Okay, who else has one to read? Thank you.
Okay. Can I read? Want me to hold baby while you're doing that?
She was the last to leave the room. Her father's body lay near the back in a VFW color guard uniform. She hadn't looked at it, but could see it well. Her 10-year-old nephew had tucked a note inside his grandpa's pocket. Dear Grandpa, I hope you have lots of toys for you to play with in heaven, especially a backhoe. Someday I'll see you, and then you can teach me how to weld. I'll bring the welder. But she wasn't able to look. Even her brother's girlfriend had touched him, the one who said, "I didn't know that was what it was called," when she read the 23rd Psalm in the little part of it, given them when they arrived at the funeral home. So dark and small in there after the spring sun on snow outside.
There, and we'll go for a walk.
Oh, good buddy, you okay?
New face. New face.
Meet us for last year. The man who said, "I didn't know that was what it was called," when she read the 23rd Psalm from a little card given up when they arrived at the funeral home. And was referring to the funeral home, so dark and small after the spring sun on snow outside. They were all gone now. Her uncle, who looked so much like him, the many cousins who had all counted on their Uncle Melvin. She was tired, wanted space, wanted peace. It had been a long few days. It all started with a phone call at 1:30 a.m. Dad died. Her sister's voice. She made travel arrangements, wrote lesson plans for school, planned for her husband to follow in a day or two, and then on the way to the airport, they stopped at the fertility clinic they had been going to the past year. This was visit 5 of a possible 6. They would do no more than that, not wanting anything invasive or anything that might cause multiple births. It was a day or two too soon. Most likely it wouldn't work. Now she sat alone with her father, not knowing what she would discover later. The face she chose not to see again, the smile, the dimples, the thoughtful look is there now, the grandson her father would never see.
Is that your story?
Yes. It's complete the day his grandfather died.
Well, that's a wonderful story. Goodness sakes. Tell us what you liked about it, people. You got a talent for putting words on the paper.
That's beautiful.
What do you do? Oh, yeah, it's written very well.
So many word pictures.
Yeah, the concrete use of detail, those specific details of what time did the fall come, for example, and when did, don't take the baby back yet. Read us, the first line again.
The one you gave me?
No, after that.
Her father's body laying near the back in a VFW color guard uniform.
So we know what the body's wearing. And then she goes on to say she won't look at him even though she sees him. And then
her ransom put in my car when you're in his pocket. That was so cute.
Yeah.
All toys.
Right. I'll bring the welder.
Isn't that wonderful?
Girl, touch it. Just so many of those details are so important. And then she uses the device of saying it all started with, you know, because the line I gave you is really the closing line of the story. But you can use it to automatically flip back into it all started with. And so she does the it all started with and the phone call at 1:30 in the morning and all the details of lesson plans and her husband found her a couple days later and then stopping at the fertility clinic. And then you right away got those two themes going of death and birth. Lots of stuff about passing down, you know, seeing her father's features in the uncle's face. And so many things that start to knit together there. It really works nicely. Mm-hmm. And then here's the last line.
The face she chose not to see again, the smile, the dimples, the thoughtful look. Is there now the grandson her father will never see?
So of course that pulls it, you know, sort of ties the thing up into a package and makes a ball. Very, very effective. Just lovely. I mean, all those details make so much difference when they come together. She didn't have time to think, let's see, now I'm going to talk about faces and symbols of all her family and, you know, what gets passed on and stuff. But she was just telling the story, but all that stuff comes out of it when they hear that. Okay, who's next? Come on.
Yes, that's a hard act to follow.
They all are. Every story has its own merit.
I woke to my dad rubbing my back and telling him that he loved me. Little did I know that he was dying. I remember the good feeling that he was with me, having lost my mother only a year before. A special closeness had developed between us, and I treasured our relationship. The closeness that I felt at that moment was very special. Hours later, I would again be awakened by my pastor with the message that my dad had suffered a heart attack and died during the night. He had known that he was dying, and he had gone to both my brother and me and told us that he loved us, and that we'd always be cared for. I'm sorry. At the time, and in our state of half-awakeness, neither of us understood what he was trying to tell us. We only understood later how he was saying goodbye and leaving us. And I will always treasure that special feeling I felt.
Well, the power of that story comes right out of the story. You know, here's a child, and somehow we knew she was a child, don't you think? I mean, were you picturing someone who's 30 or someone who was a child?
I thought maybe 30. I thought maybe that he came to her while she was sleeping. You know, and
oh, I see.
And came, you know, as the after they died, and you know how sometimes you see people after they die and they right. Say bye.
I had the sense that you were a child, but I completely understand that interpretation too. But there, you know, she really went right to the heart of it. She told the central story in a very direct and plain way.
Don't waste time telling your kids you love them.
But he knew him. He knew.
Six months before, he had a minor heart attack. But his heart was damaged enough that if he had another one, he'd probably die. Because of that.
And he knew that you were then going to be orphaned. Mm-hmm. And so his priority, you learned so much from his priorities at that point, coming and waking his two children and saying he loved them. So what a powerful witness that is. Mm-hmm. What a dear man. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And reassuring you, you'll always be cared for. I thought that was... Mm-hmm. You know, here's this child half awake, half asleep, you know, and that you remembered that. Mm-hmm. And yet all the rest of it is hazy. It's almost like you were sleeping. I mean, you don't tell us anything around that. Mm-hmm. But it's like in your sleep, this one image comes to you. So it's very powerful in that way. It really communicates what happened. And were you cared for?
Yes. By the aunt and uncle, and the next door. And stay together.
Good.
And a brother that I used to fight with, as typical brothers and sisters do at about that age. Mm-hmm. From the day my dad died, that stopped.
No more.
We were just good friends.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't afford to anymore.
Mm-hmm. We both had to grow up a little faster than most. You said so much in so few words. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the more I think about it, the more it really does communicate this being awakened in the night business. Mm-hmm. And it's what it was like, everything around it is a haze and just that image of that, what he said. Thank you.